Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and at 1300 hours GMT on Tuesday, the 30th of July, these are our main stories. In a surprise announcement, the Chinese government claims it's released most of the ethnic Uyghur and Muslims held in heavily guarded detention centres. The American rapper ASAP Rocky has pleaded not guilty to assaulting a teenage refugee in Sweden. Also in this podcast, it's going wrong for the North Atlantic right whale. The species is endangered once again. We'll have a report from Canada's East Coast.
These are busy waters, immensely busy waters, year round. Lots of gear, lots of people in boats, whether they're big vessels, little vessels. They're in the middle of a city.
It's thought there could be hundreds of thousands of ethnic Uyghurs and other Muslims held in heavily guarded detention centres in China's far west Xinjiang province. The Chinese government has previously denied these camps exist. But now, in a surprise announcement, officials there have said most of them have been released. I asked our correspondent in Beijing, Celia Hatton, what reason they'd given.
They haven't really given an explanation. They're trying to paint this as a successful conclusion to what they say is a pioneering program to tackle terrorism and extremism. So they say that most of the trainees have graduated, as they put it. When they were pushed on numbers, they couldn't really give any. They said that the conditions were very fluid. But then one official said he thought around 90% of the so-called graduates have returned home. And then the officials emphasized that they are now getting new jobs and this has all gone very well. So they were trying to put forth a very shiny, happy result for this incredibly controversial program.
Yes, 90% of the graduates. So do we know how many were detained? And a little bit more then about why they were there in the first place.
Well, we don't know very much beyond what was said today. And frankly, this is almost impossible to verify and really should be taken with a massive grain of salt. Now, China likes to paint these detention camps as vocational centers where they're just simply teaching new skills. But the truth is that these are places where people can be held for months or years at a time without ever being charged with anything, without being going to trial. Witnesses who've seen people exit the camps, people who've been through the camps themselves, say that they're subjected to torture and brainwashing. Estimates vary, frankly, between a few hundred thousand people to around 3 million people have been through these camps. So, but most experts kind of coalesce around the 1 million figure. But the big point is we simply don't know.
But there's been a lot of focus on these camps. The BBC's China correspondent John Sudworth, in fact, went inside one recently.
Thousands are being detained. Mosques are disappearing. And thoughts are being transformed. We go inside the camps to ask what's really happening to China's Muslims.
Is it also to do with the fact that the world has turned its attention to these camps and doesn't like what it sees?
Absolutely. I mean, this simply just adds to China's problems, doesn't it? It probably went ahead with what it thought was quite a clever solution to dealing with rising calls for independence in Xinjiang. But China has a whole host of problems that it's dealing with right now. It's got a U.S.-China trade war. It's got protests in Hong Kong. It's got a whole host of problems to do with its sliding economy. And to be honest, I think it really just wants to deal with this problem and kind of clean it up in Chinese terms before it hosts the next Olympics in 2022. So it is now that the world's attention is really starting to focus on these camps. It's struggling with how to put a public relations veneer on what appears to be a very, very dark chapter in Chinese history.
Celia Hatton. I came, I saw, I praise the Lord, then break the law. I take what's mine, then take some more. It rains, it pours, it rains, it pours. I came. What you're hearing is American rapper A$AP Rocky's hit Praise the Lord. He is in court in Sweden, in the Swedish capital Stockholm today, accused of assaulting a 19-year-old man in a street fight after spending much of the past month in custody. A$AP Rocky has always said it was self-defense, and he's even had the support of the US president, who offered to pay his bail. Here's President Trump speaking last week.
I have been called by so many people asking me to help A$AP Rocky. Actually, the one who knew about A$AP Rocky was our first lady, right? And she was telling me about, can you help A$AP Rocky? Do you want to give a little statement on that?
Well, we're working with State Department, and we hope to get him home soon.
Well, their intervention didn't work. Our reporter Maddie Savage is outside the court in Stockholm. And a short time ago, I asked her what Sweden made of the comments by the president and the first lady and other famous names coming forward in the United States.
I think Sweden thinks it's rather bizarre that somebody from the other side of the world, President Trump, is trying to get so involved in the Swedish justice service here. It's the case in Sweden that nobody is allowed bail. Once they're arrested, they're typically kept in a detention centre until their trial begins. And that's exactly what's happened to A$AP Rocky and the other two people who are accused of being involved in the fight with him. Just to let you know, the court case is underway, and we've just seen A$AP Rocky's lawyer speeding up the road in a car with a huge scrum of media journalists standing outside trying to capture those pictures now. We estimate around 70 journalists from at least 40 different media organisations are here, no doubt spurred on by the high-profile nature of this trial, given the intervention from President Trump and huge other global celebrities like Kim Kardashian West and Justin Bieber.
So let's go over what's alleged to have happened then.
So this all dates back to around a month ago. A$AP Rocky, not hugely well known here in Sweden before this trial, but he was here in Stockholm to perform at a hip-hop festival. And a couple of days before, he was out in the city centre when he got involved in a fight outside a burger bar. Now, he and those who were with him say that they were acting in self-defence in this fight. There's videos showing him, A$AP Rocky, appearing to push the victim to the ground. But he and his group say that they were acting in self-defense because the victim and some of his friends were following them around. And he has officially denied the assault charges he's facing in court today.
And there's new evidence, apparently, from his lawyer. What have they produced?
A huge amount of evidence has been compiled ahead of this trial. A 552-page document submitted before proceedings began, and that includes everything from text message between A$AP Rocky and some of his friends and family to pictures of the victim's injuries and photos of the bottle, potentially a very crucial piece of evidence involved in this case. But we've spoken to the lawyer of one of the two other suspects who says that crucial new evidence that neither journalist nor the court have seen yet will be submitted during the trial, including testimonies from two new witnesses. So we'll have to wait and see what that involves. If A$AP Rocky, if the trial doesn't go his way, he could face up to 2 years in prison for this kind of crime.
Maddie Savage in Stockholm. Bans on rosewood logging and trade have been in place in Ghana for years, but according to the Environmental Investigation Agency, more than 500,000 tonnes of that timber, the equivalent of 6 million trees, have been exported to China from Ghana since the bans were in place. The organisation behind this new report says the illegal rosewood logging and trade have had a devastating impact on Ghana's forests and the communities that depend on them. The BBC's Shaima Khalil got more details from the EIA director, Sasha von Bismarck.
There have been bans over the last few years. Each ban has tried to fix the previous one. The current one is on paper quite complete. It says you can't log, you can't transport, and it went as far as to say that you also can't issue the CITES permits, the permits from the Endangered Species Convention. And that's what we found is being just directly flouted. Those permits are just for sale, basically.
Despite these bans, there is a large-scale illegal logging of rosewood that you've uncovered. Just give me an idea about the scale of that. What numbers are we talking about? What amounts?
It's devastating because these trees are very valuable in their own right. And even more importantly, they occupy a very important role in the kind of ecosystems that are on the tipping point between arable land that is useful for agriculture and land that is beset by desertification. And by taking out these trees, you're actually triggering the desertification process that is such a problem for Ghana. Since about 2012, there have been 6 million trees, or 540,000 tons, or 23,000 containers, that kind of volume of flat-out illegal wood stolen from Ghana to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars that, of course, themselves would be very well spent in other ways. But there are many very strong reform-minded people and civil society groups on the ground that are calling the alarm and making clear that this wood in particular is what has to be paid attention to. The model is there, model of transparency of the permits, model of actually tracing the wood from the forest on its way out all the way to China. The capacity to do that is there. It just needs to be applied to this incredibly precious tree.
Sascha von Bismarck there from the Environmental Investigation Agency. The North Atlantic right whale was hunted to near extinction by the 1890s. Listed as endangered for decades, they are now showing signs of a slow recovery. However, the species is again under threat. Jessica Murphy sent us this report from Canada's East Coast.
The call of a North Atlantic right whale. They're among the most endangered large whales on the planet. Only about 400 of them are left. And right now, they're being killed faster than they can reproduce. It's here in the Gulf of St. Lawrence where 8 right whales have died so far this year. Ship strikes, climate change, and fishing gear dropped from boats like the one I'm standing on and picked up somewhere along the whale's migration route are the main threats facing this endangered species. Most right whales are dying after being hit by ships or tangled in fishing gear. Tanya Wimmer from the Marine Animal Response Society says it's inevitable for them to come into contact with human activity in their habitat, which ranges from Florida to Canada.
These are busy waters, immensely busy waters, year-round. Lots of gear, lots of people in boats, whether they're big vessels, little vessels. They're in the middle of a city. And that's probably the hardest thing for them to cope with.
In the Gulf of St. Lawrence, regulators have brought in measures to try and protect the whales, setting speed restrictions on boats and closing some areas to snow crab and lobster fisheries, with mixed results. Along with the 8 dead whales, another 3 have been spotted wrapped up in fishing ropes, which can be lethal to the animal. Watch out! Cutting free an entangled 70-ton whale, one that can grow to the length of a bowling lane, is risky work.
Watch the tail, Gary.
The danger is, you know, the whale changing course and bumping into the boat, knocking the boat over, or slapping the boat with the tail or something like that.
Mackie Green heads the Campobello Whale Rescue Team, one of the few qualified to lead such missions along the Atlantic seaboard.
Something that you can't train people to do just in the classroom.
A former fisherman himself, Green knows the survival of the species is at stake, but so is a key industry on Canada's east coast.
It's real important for me to save the whales, but it's also important for me to help save the fishery.
Efforts are underway to develop new fishing technology and methods that are safer for whales, but most solutions are years away. If nothing changes, right whales could become extinct within 30 years. But the species has proven resilient when given the chance, and those working to save the right whales haven't lost hope.
Nobody wants this problem to persist. Nobody wants to be around to see that last whale die. We want to make sure that these things continue to exist.
Jessica Murphy with that report. Still to come on this podcast, an eagerly awaited long-lost album by jazz trumpeter Miles Davis.
The challenge was to keep the essence of what we did then and then stretch it to where it's still viable today.
Our correspondent gets a sneak preview. Here in London, the Royal Courts of Justice are hearing a petition over the welfare of 2 children of estranged parents. Not unusual in itself, but in this case, the parents are the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed, and his Jordanian wife, Princess Haya, who fled the Emirates several weeks ago along with their children. Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner, looks at the case.
It was pretty mysterious. She fled first to Germany with her children and then to Britain. And it was then revealed that she was living in a very expensive £85 million property, we're told, in Kensington, in a very exclusive area, but then living allegedly in fear of her life. Why? Because her husband, her estranged husband, the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has penned a very angry poem, which he's published, or an account linked to him has published on Instagram, accusing an unnamed woman of betrayal and treachery and throwing away the thing most close and betraying his trust. And she is, I'm told by friends, very scared of reprisals and of being abducted even. Now, there is no comment from his side. The UAE embassy saying this is a private matter between two individuals. The reason why that this is particularly shocking is that this is now the third runaway female from the Royal Court of Dubai. So last year, there was somebody called Sheikha Latifa, who is one of Sheikh Mohammed's daughters, who put out a video, you may remember it, saying, if you're watching this, then I'm in deep trouble. And she was very unhappy with her life. She felt that he was very controlling. And she made a break to go and live a separate life. She was helped by a Frenchman. She escaped by sea, first to Imam, and then by sea. They got as far as off the coast of India when their yacht was stormed by Emirati and Indian commandos, and she was brought back to Dubai. Now, I'm told by Princess Haya's confidence that she discovered the truth about that and was really horrified, and that's one of the reasons why she has fled.
Our security correspondent, Frank Gardner. As Syrian government forces backing President Bashar al-Assad retake ground with the help of Russia and Iran, the conflict has fallen out of the headlines. The United Nations Security Council is meeting later today to discuss the humanitarian situation in that country. Karen Pearce, the UK ambassador to the UN, spoke to the BBC earlier.
I think there's indifference on the part of the Russians and the Syrian government about what's happening in that country. I think the rest of the international community are extremely concerned. I mean, the UK has given over £2.8 billion for the crisis in Syria to date. The Security Council would like to pass resolutions mandating humanitarian deliveries and indeed mandating that the airstrikes on Idlib stop and that the parties abide by international humanitarian law. The problem, I'm afraid, comes down to those two countries, Syria and Russia, aided and abetted by Iran.
And in the northwest Idlib province, the fighting continues and the death toll amongst civilians is rising. More than 100 people have been killed in the past 2 weeks. The BBC's Dan Damon got more information on the current situation in Idlib from Amer Gamalo of the humanitarian agency, the Violet Organization.
The upsurge in violence endangers about 3 million people in the northwest of Syria, in Idlib, in Hama, in Aleppo.
What kind of attacks are there?
There was so many shelling, air strikes, including the use of indiscriminate weapons, like barrel bombs, all kinds of weapons were used in the attacks.
And who's in Idlib at the moment?
Of course, civilians like me, humanitarian workers like other people.
And what is the day-to-day life like? The threat of the attacks is obviously terrible, but what about things like water, food? How do you keep going?
A lot of people are working in their farms, selling, buying, all parts of life, so they can earn their living.
What about water? Is the water running?
Just from wells that need so many pumps to get them out. We need machine pumps to get the water out of the well.
And, Amir, what about people fleeing? With all of this going on and the conditions as bad as you say, are people leaving?
Yeah, since the end of April, there have been over 440,000 displacements from northern Hama and southern Idlib governorates. Many of them have been evacuated and have fled multiple times, some five, others 10 times. They were evacuated to a nearby village, and then this village was targeted, and they will flee again to another one.
Amma Gamalo. Finally, an eagerly awaited long-lost album by jazz trumpeter Miles Davis is released this autumn. Rubber Band has been finished by the original producers and Davis's nephew, Vince Wilburn Jr. The album, with a cover showing a painting by Davis, sheds new light on one of the most influential, acclaimed and controversial figures in the history of jazz and 20th century music. Nicholas Stanbridge has had an early listen.
If you don't mind, we'd like to play something for you.
In 1985, Miles Davis began recording the Rubber Band sessions, with several tracks like this one, Paradise, never reaching the light of day until now, thanks to the original musicians, including nephew Vince Wilburn Jr. playing drums.
I call it Miles Davis University because he's the professor. He was the head chemist. And we were all just, you know, in this lab under the direction of Uncle Miles, you know. It was an exciting time. You had to be ready for anything.
Was music taken into the studio, written music at all?
Just forms, you know, and just ideas. It's better that way. Randy Hall and Zane Giles, the composers, had a lot to do with it.
Basically, almost like lived in the studio during that time. Here, you have brand new music from Miles Davis right now at this time. This is it. He didn't play that live.
No. The challenge was to keep the essence of what we did then and then stretch it to where it's still viable today. Well, give it up. He loved James Brown. He loved Prince. It was like one take and he just blew it out.
And what was Miles Davis like during those sessions? Take us back in time.
He would bring in his art supplies. He would just sit up and nod with his approval, and he's painting, and he's drawing pictures of us, and we started boxing. Because, you know, Miles used to box, and I used to box, so we were just having fun. Echoes in Time, Miles played these chords, and then he went and got his trumpet, and then he played over it. He was almost like reminiscing,
yeah, you know, reflections
about his life and about this music and this feeling that he had. Hear him hitting the valves on the trumpet.
You know, when he did Kind of Blue, it was sketches. It was modal music. Ideas that he had written out for the guys. In one or two takes, that's what you hear. And then a lot of music that he recorded, he didn't want to go past one or two takes because he said you would lose the spontaneity and the energy from the musicians. So you had to get it on, you know, one or two, and that was it. You know, else the record day was canceled. He never wanted to look back.
Miles Davis explained shortly before his death in a 1991 interview with Ben Sidran.
Don't like me because I'm Kind of Blue. Like me for what I'm, you know, for what we're doing, you know. I was put here to play music and interpret music. That's what I do. No attitude, nothing. That's all I want to do. And I do it good, you know?
He didn't want to repeat himself. He always kept the music evolving.
He would often lose fans, often annoy the critics.
Miles Davis biographer George Cole.
He was always challenging himself and in doing so challenging the music world. And, you know, if you look at his body of work, you know, from Kind of Blue to the music he did in the 60s with the Second Great Quintet to the music of the 70s with jazz rock with Bitches Brew and Jack Johnson, he was always pushing forward. He always wanted to be popular. He always wanted to have as wide an audience as possible.
When Miles called me to apologize that they were basically shelving the album. I said, well, hey, man, whether it's now or whether it's years from now, not knowing that it was going to be 30-something years from now, I said, believe me, we're going to finish this record. That's a promise to you.
We hope that he's proud of it. He's probably looking down. Either grinning or wanting to kick our, you know what. You know, but he comes to me in dreams, so I hope he comes to me in a dream with a smile.
Nicholas Ambridge on the new Miles Davis album. Only a few weeks or so to wait for Rubber Band. It is out this September. And that is all from us for now. But there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can. Just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.